This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Today, I am going to interview Bree Dale. She is the Rome correspondent for Daily Wire. She has read Pope Benedict's new book. It just came out this week. It is only in Italian. I do not read Italian. So we're going to talk to Bree about this book and a lot else, of course. Of course, you know, I'm interviewing her on one thing, but we're going to talk about a lot of things. And this episode is being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project, standing in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world. Go to thegreatcampaign.org, join the team, become a monthly donor, check out what we do. If you're like, wow, I wish I could do that, you can by becoming a monthly donor, thegreatcampaign.org. This episode is also being brought to you by Epoch Times. If you want to stay free, you got to stay informed. And the CCP is menacing the world. Epoch Times is the CCP's least favorite paper. If you want to subscribe to the CCP's least favorite paper and my favorite paper for only a dollar for the first month, go to iReadEpoch.com. Use the code Jason Jones. All right? Bree Dale from the Daily Wire, Rome correspondent on the Jason Jones Show. Dale, Rome correspondent for the Daily Wire. Welcome to the Jason
Hello,
Jones
Jason.
Show. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be able to talk with you, my friend.
I am so glad to have you on the podcast. Is this the first time you're on the show?
I think so, yeah. I think it fits in the first of many topics that we've discussed off air as well.
Well, since meeting you, I'm like, I have to have you on the podcast, but you're in Rome and I'm everywhere else. And so syncing is challenging.
Yes, it is.
So, but this is, I was talking to our mutual friend and my coworker, Marilis Pinheiro, whose dog Romeo is trying to jump on my lap right now. And she said, Bree has read or has almost completed Pope Benedict's new book. I'm like, we have to, because it's in Italian and the news is reporting on it. And of course, they're going to make it salacious and try to create controversy and division. And so I thought we need to get a show with Bree ASAP.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. No, like the book is in Italian right now. I was told, actually tweeted at by Ignatius Press, that they are going to be printing it in English, but the time is TBD. So we're not sure when that's going to be printed. In English. So I'm doing my best, but my translations are always going to be rough. And I want to make that very clear. It's the reason why I put working translation out. First, I'm not an official translator. So that's the point that needs to be made. But secondly, there are nuances in Italian, just like there are nuances in English and there are nuances in German, which some of these were written in German and translated into English, into Italian, that aren't being captured. So I want people to understand that I'm doing my best, and it's enough to be able to read it, to get a first glimpse, and the glimpses have been amazing. Really,
well, you
amazing.
you have a subtle thought for Pope Benedict was a subtle thinker, a thoughtful thinker, who touched the issues of the age. So yeah. When you have a subtle, thoughtful thinker communicating on the issues of the age in German and in Italian, and then a thoughtless sensationalist media telling us about it, a lot is getting lost in the translation. So let's just begin with, what is the title in Italian and how would you roughly translate it into English?
So again, my poor pronunciation, but it is Che cos'è il cristianismo. And it's, mi dispiace to those people who speak Italian. And what it really is in a sense is both a question and maybe a statement. What is Christianity, or like why Christianity? And it's just, it's, a compilation of many of his thoughts post his papacy. So when he was at the monastery, and it was his desire to always continue to write and to think of these things. And I have to tell you, I read a lot out of the Vatican, a lot of statements out of Pope Francis and other theologians of today. And to just be able to read Pope Benedict and his way of thinking, it was like drinking from a nice, cool spring. It was very clear. It was thoughtful and philosophical and theological, but very well connected thoughts, where I tend to find a lot of the statements today out of the Vatican and elsewhere to not be so connected. They always have a purpose, but they're not always smooth. You know, so I just want to say, like, reading this was it was refreshing to me as a journalist going through, and just he's just so gentle in the way that he approaches things, but also very straightforward, like a German.
Yeah, so I think maybe it would be to be fair, Pope Benedict transcends the spirit of the age, and Francis, right. I believe, if I'm being charitable, is trying to speak into the spirit of the age, if not having been captured by the spirit of the age. Maybe he's just trying that's the difference, right?
I feel like it's just totally different approaches to theology. You know, some Jesuits are very, like, straightforward, direct. You know, if this, then this. You know, it's kind of almost a syllogism in philosophy, you know. If this equals this and this equals that, then this equals that. That's how I tend to hear a lot of Jesuits teach, or they focus on history or politics. And so it's not surprising to have Pope Francis be very similar. And I think Pope Francis, oftentimes, the way that he approaches things can be, he tries to make things simple at times when he speaks with people. But I think his brain goes 50,000 miles a minute. And so, and I have this problem too, oftentimes, where I think I'm getting a point across when I'm writing an article. And then my editors are like, well, we don't actually get, where did you get all of this? You kind of went down a rabbit hole. And then, like, I have to re-edit it a bit. And then I'm like, oh, okay, there's a connection there, Jason. I could see where my mind was at the time and where they're not, you know, catching up or whatnot with the way that I'm looking. So I think very similarly, that's how Pope Francis thinks. And I mean, it's a way of approaching things where, you know, the mind of Pope Benedict, not only being a German, but really a theologian and a biblical theologian, what really struck me in some of these passages that he writes is that, you know, he had been working, Jason, on books on the life of Christ and books reflective of the early Christian fathers and whatnot during his pontificate, right? And you can get those now.
I own... them all.
They're amazing.
He wrote faster than I can read. And all of those books by Ignatius were beautifully bound. And I bought them all.
They're amazing. They're amazing contemplative works. And I think his mind has been in the inquiry of getting to know the person of Jesus through the scriptures. And so you read a lot of that in his text, the connection with scriptures, and how it's interwoven when current society. And he speaks with such a force, a gentle force, but a force of this is what we believe and this is why we believe it. You know, so he doesn't really speak to the spirit of the age. He speaks for Catholicism addressing the spirit of the age. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Do you think the difference, too, between Pope Francis and Pope Benedict is, I've often thought if I'm going to stand outside of the 2,000-year history of the church, and I were to pick a time, I can only pick one time to study the writings of Catholic thinkers, would be those thinkers that lived through the early to middle part of the 20th century, because it was the greatest catastrophes in the history of Christendom. the Bolshevik Revolution, the rise of totalitarian socialism and fascism, World War One and World War Two. And I would if I just stood outside of the history of the church and said, okay, when would be the most interesting time to read the writings of Christian thinkers? I would have picked the time that Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, St. John Paul the Great, Elizabeth Anscombe, Dietrich von Hildebrand. I would have picked these thinkers, and I would have picked that time because they would have kind of been thrust into very serious thinking on God, man, and the world that maybe Christians writing in other times, with the exception of maybe St. Augustine, would not have had.
Right. You know, that's definitely a possibility. I think I would also posit when it comes to Pope Francis is that you really have to look at his formation in the Jesuits in South America. Because during that time in South America, there was a lot of political upheaval and whatnot. And so I think, and they were involved with it in South America. And so I think Francis's approach is to try to look at Christianity through a worldview. Does that make sense? So he's like, okay, I want to play, I want to do benefit of the doubt to those who are in the world who may not know Christ, as I do. And to try to approach Christianity in a way that meets them where they're at. And so I think he's very successful, Jason, on that. I think that he speaks, you know, recently Pope Francis did this massive, I'm sure you'd like to talk about this, but this massive interview with the AP. And I also translated it. It was in Spanish. I also used AI to help translate it very, very quickly so that people could at least read what he said directly from the transcripts versus the reports from AP, which were very, very manipulated, I believe, for a political purpose.
Okay, that's good to hear.
But very manipulated. But Pope Francis spoke about homosexuality as a sin, and he also spoke of it in a political sense as condemning countries that and states that have laws criminalizing homosexuality. And he gives some examples, but I really do think that he is looking at current state of the world where there are very harsh laws in the secular world against homosexuality, and the criminalization of it ends with death.
Well, let me ask you this question. So, let me ask you this question. So I saw that and I was very angry. And I'll tell you why I was angry. First of all, to put it in context, my organization, VPP, rescued, as strange as this is going to sound, the LGBT activists working for Western organizations in Afghanistan when Afghanistan collapsed.
Right.
Because the organizations that they worked for sent them emails basically saying, we're not liable for what's about to happen. Peace out. Got to go. And they reached out to us sheepishly because they heard we were having success rescuing folks. We even rescued people that worked for organizations that were promoting the culture of death, like abortion and contraception. And we rescued them. Okay.
Right.
So obviously, if I find out, you know, if VPP gets a message from someone, hey, I'm in China, because the CCP kills, you know, it's homosexuality is punishable, I think, up to death in China, in Saudi Arabia. But the reason it made me mad, and I'm going to be honest, I get quite frustrated with Pope Francis as someone who runs an apostolate serving the vulnerable, because I can't help but feel he is a victimist who feigns concerns for popular communities that aren't extremely vulnerable. And so I'm like, yes, Pope Francis, please talk about what the CCP does to homosexuals, Saudi Arabia, name them, but you won't. But also, they've disappeared seven Catholic bishops, tens of thousands of Catholic lady. Jimmy Lai is dying in prison. So Nigeria, we had 50 Catholic girls kidnapped last week. VPP.
What happened?
Yeah. Where are you? When the Christians were being wiped off the face of the earth in Iraq, the Pope was beaming wild animals onto St. Peter's to bring attention to global warming. Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So this is my frustration with Pope Francis. I don't believe he's a boomer. To use the term of Gen Z, they're all a bunch of boomers. They're rent-seeking boomers that want to be liked, and it's gross. Where you have Pope Benedict, a man who his spiritual life was birth in a horrible, menacing tyranny. And so he takes ideas very serious. He's not a dilettante who plays with ideas. You know, there's a very popular Catholic religious person in English-speaking world who's a dilettante who plays with authors and philosophers and poets, and he makes these podcasts that are basically, you know, for Jesuit kids who went to Jesuit schools and are barely clinging to their faith, so their parents write him checks to make blah. Okay, great. But yet, I've never seen this popular Catholic religious person, you know, with the Roman collar who makes videos talking about T.S. Eliot and Rene Girard. I've never heard him talk about the Catholics in Nigeria, Iraq and Syria, the CCP, or homosexuals in those countries. Because I'll be the first to go over there and spend money and work phones. And my Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant donors are the ones writing checks to save Uyghurs and Yazidis.
And Jason, that's the point. I think you're 100% on board. We're in agreement.
Forgive the rant. Sign up for the lecture, but I get angry at this stuff.
No, and I know that I feel like a lot of people are confused on that. And I think it's really important to voice confusion while also saying that, you know, when it comes to infallibility with the Pope, he is on things, a declared ex cathedra on faith and morals, right? But when it comes to interviews or what he does and does not do, you know, he's not exactly infallible there. And I think it's important for people to realize that it is okay to question and say, how does this work? But I think also, in the case of his statement to the AP with regards to really coming out and condemning, secular laws again that criminalize homosexuals, his point and the points that followed that were not in the report by AP that you have to find in his actually transcript. He goes further to say, really, again, very similar to what you said, which is, you know, we have to care for the human person. We have to care for the soul. And he reiterates that homosexuality as an act is a sin, but you can't, like, with the sinner, we hope for redemption, right? So this is an ongoing full process, and there are many different layers to, you know, the mission of the church. And what you just discussed about rescuing the human persons who were being persecuted and really under threat because specifically of some of those criminal laws, you did what the church should be doing, you know, and which actually drives many people into the church eventually and wanting to reform their lives, whether it's in any case of sin. You know, and different grave sins, different gravity for different grave sins, of course, right? But like, we still have to realize that we are on a journey. And I think that's what Pope Francis really has done very well in talking about, like, we're not in a world that is black and white. You know, clearly there are sins that are intrinsically evil. But we're not in a world that is black and white. And human beings are in an ongoing battle towards the good. But how he expresses it often can be very confusing. And again, I think that goes back to his Jesuit upbringing in South America, where it really is this kind of secular humanist formation first, and then later goes on to like the theological transcripts, where it's like before, you know, it would be in formation, especially in Jesuit formation, and almost militant, but very highly educated, the theological, philosophical formation, 8 years, plus they would take a fourth vow of complete obedience to the Pope, which we know likely doesn't really happen much now, considering certain Jesuits have been very outspokenly disobedient to popes in Pope's past. So
do you think,
we are in a position.
And I don't want to lure you into this debate, but I'm sorry, but do you sure. think... I see him as either very naive, very clever, or X. Because let's take this conversation on homosexuality. Right. It's in the context of Russia-Ukraine, right? Where right. Ukraine is flying under the banner of the rainbow flag. And Putin is this, you know, illiberal monster who is going to crack down on homosexuals. I would like the Pope to look in the camera and say, I'm not playing your game. You're not using me to gaslight the world to send tanks to Ukraine to potentially escalate this war to a global thermonuclear war. I'm not going to promote your war to the last Ukrainian to advance the interests. I have an article coming out how NATO and Russia are basically playing the same game Germany with Ukraine that Germany and Russia played with Poland. It's just a new business model. But the reality is oligarchs in Ukraine and Russia and the United States are padding their pockets. They've already, I'm in D.C., I already got the word, they're already handing out the reconstruction contracts for Ukraine.
Of course.
You can bet your dollar that this war will be winding down. The tanks, they said, they won't get there for a year. The war will be over before then. And, you know, Blackstone or whatever, they'll be getting their contracts.
Yep.
And it's gross. So is the Pope naive? Does he not know he's being gaslit or being used to gaslight the world? Or is he clever and going and he wants to encourage it? Or is there something I'm missing?
I think it's only, speak as a journalist, I think it's only for the Pope to make his intentions known on that. What I can do as someone who assesses, and I try to do so objectively, I do believe in this pontificate, and I said this to another individual who is fairly well known on social media, but I won't give their names, but I said it recently. I do believe that the political nature of, because, you know, the Pope wears multiple hats, right? He is first and foremost the head of the Catholic Church, but he's also head of a city state, right? So and a political city state, one that has wielded in times past real significant influence, something that I think has been lost quite a bit, especially with regards to the Sino-Vatican deal. But that's for another conversation. But with regards to whether or not he is naive, I do believe that he has chosen on his part to be one who delegates quite a bit in order to have plausible deniability. So he doesn't do a lot. He doesn't watch a lot of TV, from what I've been told. He reads one particular newspaper.
Stream.org?
In the morning.
John Zmierak, Jason Jones at the stream.org. Is that what he reads?
Nope.
Yeah, you broke it here. Daily Wire break story. No, because if he read the stream, we would never get the meetings that we get. I just know they don't read what I write. They're like, okay, we'll meet with this guy. They have no clue.
And sometimes it's okay to have that happen. I will say, what I've experienced, Jason, and I posted this on social media for a reason, actually Facebook and Instagram for a reason the other day, is what I've experienced is a very serious and very difficult road here, reporting accurately, consistently, and with ethics, because the lack of ethics on both sides of the reporting out and polarized political side, which sadly that's where a lot of the church is nowadays, whether it's quote unquote conservative or liberal, it's made it very, very difficult to actually report factually and honestly. And it hurts because one side supposedly says we have the truth and we believe truth is objective and it's factual. And the other side says truth is subjective and my truth and whatnot. And if you start from those pillars, you kind of know where you're going with people. But sadly, on the side that claims, you know, truth is objective, their actions are proving otherwise and very political. And so when that happens, and this goes back to what does the Pope know? The Pope delegates, and he, I believe, is briefed, very similar to the way the president is briefed on things. And the people who brief him are individuals who are kind of in the background. I'll name two of them. I'll name two of them. Father Rozica is one who has in the past gone to Pope Francis and has briefed him. And I know Father James Martin has done so too. But there's a group of individuals, many of them Jesuits.
Father Rozica is a monster. I'm just going to tell you that. I know for a fact. This guy, Father Rozica, when our movie Bella came out, was so shocked and offended by our movie Bella. We were naive, and we were in Canada. He set us up and tried to leak who we were and what our movie was before the voting for the Toronto National Film Festival. Fact. This is not hearsay. We were warned by his staff, who said, do not come on his interview. He's gonna put it on the tomorrow. But he promised he wouldn't. And then members of his staff like met with us. We showed up at his studio, and they were like the very Orthodox Catholic women begging us that he hates you. He thinks you guys are right wing freaks, and he wants to throw a monkey wrench in your plans. And we left the studio, and he was so angry. So we're like, we'll come back after the festival. He's like, I don't want to do it then. I don't want to do it then. Then we knew they were telling the truth. And that's all right. I need to know about that guy is if he would have had his way, Bella would have never won the Toronto International Film Festival. I would not have had a movie career. Bella would have never been theatrically released, or it would have never gotten distribution. And all the thousands of women who chose life because of our film, that would have never happened. And Eduardo wouldn't be running for president of Mexico. That's the power these guys who slink around in the shadows have.
Right. And you know, another one is Antonio Spadaro, who, you know, we know with many of these people, they come in and out. But Spadaro has been in the Vatican for a very long time. And he's also a Jesuit and is consistently communicating with Pope Francis. But he works really behind the scenes. And why I'm bringing this up is that from what I understand, when there are things that the Pope needs to know, whether it's like cultural trends or like things that are happening on social media, because he's not connected to any of that. I mean, he has people working his social media for him. So like when there's something like videos, say, of certain inflammatory nature, and especially if these lean right, or like trad, for example, they will take these particular videos as examples to represent, say, the trad movement or the conservatives or whatnot. So it is a dangerous thing, sadly, for a pope to delegate so much of his daily briefing to people who are, like Spadaro, very much political. But it is what is the case, sadly, in this particular pontificate. But it was also the case, we know, from within other pontificates as well, which is sadly one of the reasons why, and his book, Come, Let Us Rise and Be on Our Way, the book by John Paul II, when he's discussing the sex abuse crisis of 2002, he says he took a lot. I mean, he was briefed. He allowed for those gatekeepers to brief him, and those gatekeepers briefing him on sex abuse were not actually, he just put his trust in them, and they were not giving him the full story. So I do believe, and I've seen that also, Jason, with cardinals. I'm sure you have as well. Their secretaries, they're the people around them, they're the gatekeepers. And
bishops who are my friends, yeah, who I get, yeah, they try to gatekeep me, and I love it. I'll string the game out a really long time so they can dig themselves a nice big hole. And then I'll just text them the whole thread for the past.
Put yourself in the position of, you know, the head of the Catholic Church. And I believe that Pope Francis has really depended on his Council of Nine. And if you look up some of those people who've been very close to him, they definitely are political in their activism in the church.
Wasn't there a scandal around Rosica? There was some scandal. What
was
the scandal?
Rosica has popped up recently again. But Rosica, the reason why I mentioned him is that it doesn't mean that he went away. He did, quote unquote, go away for a while to seek, I guess, help in some way. But Rosica was discovered by, I believe, Dorothy McLean, who I have to plug as an actual, like, solid investigative journalist in the conservative world. I think she's one of the only who've done this. But Dorothy McLean broke the story, and that was LifeSite, I believe, a while ago. I have to, like, be very careful on this, but she was the one, I believe, who broke the story on Rosica being a like massive plagiarist. So he had plagiarized
that's right.
so much. Right.
Yeah, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Because they're so clever.
Yeah. But when you're when there's dishonesty, it doesn't just stop.
And it went all the way back to his college days, I think.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Oh gosh. Right.
You know, I wish there were somebody I could plagiarize. There's no writer I respect that much. I just rather say what I have to say.
Why would you do that?
Like, yeah, right. Why would I write if I don't want to say what I want to say?
But I will tell you, I have discovered similar situations in the Catholic media today as well. Is that it's literal copy paste?
I was plagiarized. I'm not going to say who. A very famous Catholic priest. And I could send you the two articles. It's just absolutely unbelievable.
But lack of ethics. But see, that's where I.
Well, you know what it was? It was the ghostwriter was lazy. This is what it is, right? I don't think this was the case in Rosica, but the guy that plagiarized me. I think his ghostwriter was lazy and just kind of cut and paste. And it was.
Eventually, but I find a lot of times it is laziness. And yeah. I have to say, there are very few Catholic media. I will tell you, up until recently, I was attending every single one of the trial regarding Cardinal Becciu, every single hearing. And the only people who were showing up every single time were secular press. I did not actually one time see National Catholic Register there, or I didn't see Catholic, Church Militant. I didn't see any of these people actually report who they were reporting on the trial. They weren't actually there, and they weren't there at the briefing.
So they're reporting on other people's news reports.
On what? Or on rumors. And that's the point. It's you're living in Rome. What are you doing?
That's why we're so glad you're there.
What are you doing?
So Brie, guess what we just did by accident? We just did by accident.
What?
We did act one. We set the stage of the release of Pope Benedict's new book. So this is, we just set the stage, all the anger, the passion, the turmoil, the confusion. This is the stage that this book just dropped that we were on to talk about. So let's draw us out of this discussion I lured you into inadvertently. I apologize.
Yeah.
So now you said reading this was like drinking water from a fresh spring. I think you said something like that.
Oh,
so,
my goodness. Yeah. It was
take
it was
us
so
to
beautiful.
The take us take you. Us to the fresh. We need spring water. We've been living in Flint, Michigan. We've been living in Red Hill, Hawaii. We've been drinking water with Navy oil in it. You know about what's happening in Hawaii. We'll get to that as a Navy person. It's unbelievable. But Hawaii, which had the purest water on earth, now doesn't. And we're drinking from that tap. And now you are bringing us to this artesian well from Bavaria.
Mm. Right. So one of my favorite parts of the book that I actually just translated, and you can go onto my social media on Twitter and find it. And I think it's
what is that? I'll put it in the show notes, but so people can just go. What's your?
Oh, it's at Brie A. Dale.
Boom. How do you spell Dale?
D A I L.
There you go.
So he wrote a series of correspondence between a leading rabbi who took some issues with some of the. With some of the writings that he had produced previously, he took some issues, this rabbi, and himself. And so the rabbi, what we get first is Pope Francis Pope Benedict receiving a letter from this rabbi, Ari Folger, responding to this a letter that's not printed. From Ari Folger to some of the issues that Ari Folger had. And it's so refreshing to see the conversation that arises from this about dialogue between Jews and Christians and about really where the Catholic Church stands and should stand on Judaism and how we go about, this quote unquote dialogue, because people, I think, shrink back in hearing the term dialogue nowadays just because it's really been usurped by the left, to mean something other than that. But in this case, it really is about trying to understand and trying to help the other side, i.e., say Christians helping Jews understand where Christians stand in our beliefs. It doesn't mean we are converting you and we are seeking to, to.
Unless you're talking to me, I can promise you I'm dialoguing so I can convert you.
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to towards the end of the, the end goal is to adhere to the truth. But there, you and I have both experienced this. I have actually experienced this today on Twitter where someone came out and said, well, the Catholic Church never existed. It was developed later. And, you know, some of the really, coming from a Christian side, the anti-Catholic perspectives that are just utterly ignorant and not part of historical facts. In the same way, there are some really fundamental misunderstandings between Jews and Christians and Jews.
Yeah, it is important, and I agree with you, and it is important that Catholics understand the scandal of history. The history is an incredible scandal that I'm always amazed at my Jewish friends who become Christian, become Catholic, because I don't know if I would be able to pole vault over the scandal of history past, you know what I mean? I don't know if you would need immense, and the grace and the trauma and the tragedy. I mean, we're not born, we didn't just show up here. We were born into communities and family and history. And so that's where I think, it is very important for people to listen.
To kind of set the record, to set the record straight. And it was really, truly important for Benedict and it was made clear by Ari Folger in his response that Benedict, it was important for him to hear from someone who was considered an authority in the church to speak in this way. But can I read something,
please,
Jason, that he writes to Ari Folger? This is Benedict the 16th. Again, apologies with the rough translation. But he says, with regard to morality and worship, we can, in my opinion, recognize today more than one occurrence of a great affinity between Israel and the church. Over the entire subject, from the beginning of the modern era, lies the shadow of the anti-Jewish thought of Luther, for whom the time of the Tower experience, the no to the law, is fundamental. The event that was significant for his existence connected with Marcion's thought and generated a pseudo-religious Marcionism, which has not yet been truly challenged. I believe that precisely at this point are present important possibilities for renewed dialogue with Judaism. So his intent there was to really, and he draws it out in his second point, to really connect the political social elements of recognition of the Jewish state and Israel and the engagement between the Vatican and some of the preconceptions that took place in Europe in particular being formed out of the Luther camp. And I think it's really important because Ari goes back and confirms that completely, said, I agree. So it's a really important, I just look at this document as someone who studied diplomacy, who studied international politics, and I said, wow. In one fell swoop in this correspondence, do we actually see real diplomacy coming out of the Vatican? Like real, collaborative correspondence between two leaders of two religions and also two influencers of two states and then multiple states aside. So I found it just, it's one of the things that I just kind of keyed in on. I thought it was very interesting. You know, and then of course, a lot of people keyed in on some of the statements he made with regards to what exactly happened, what led to what he thinks was the kind of formation or foundation in the sex abuse crisis in the United States.
That was so profound. I want to stick with this point real quick on Luther.
Yeah.
The powerful poem, I think it's the most beautiful poem by Auden, is September 1939. And mm-hmm. Auden was embarrassed by it later on, and he tried to purge it, because actually in that poem he maps out how this frenzy of anti-Semitism really is found. It's birthed with Luther, and with Luther, yeah, we saw this radical. He first criticizes the church for not treating the Jews properly. And he's right. Like, watch me go convert the Jews. This is how you do it. And then when they didn't convert, he wrote the book, The Jews and Their Lies, and became rabidly anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. We see this kind of spasm, not just in the Protestant community, but we see it in the Catholic Church today, too. There is again, this sort of anti-Semitic enthusiasms erupting around the world. That I'm born in 1971. It would have seemed almost impossible in the 70s and 80s and maybe even the 90s to see this new eruption of anti-Semitism. A lot of it coming from communities, Christian communities that have been disintegrating, that these people would have been Christian Zionists 10 years ago and would have criticized me for not being a Christian Zionist. I can't be that. I'm a Catholic.
Right.
Now those same people are holding to, and you can see they've kind of, as a communities are having the same sort of flip-flop that Luther had. Does that segment, do they go into depth on that in these letters?
He does. In his second point, he talks about, in his first point, he talks about understanding and misunderstanding from the Christian perspective on the way that the Jewish people were set aside for a purpose, and how that purpose remains, even though we believe in fulfillment of the messianic promise, that didn't take away. And St. Paul makes it clear it didn't take away the importance of the Jewish law. And what happens when you adhere to the Jewish law? That's one of the reasons why Paul is like, no, I don't want more Christians bound by the Jewish law. When you read about that, because with it comes responsibility.
When you said that, there was a Babylon Bee. It just reminded me of the Babylon Bee article. I think it was Babylon Bee. It was an interview with the last guy to the Gentile to be circumcised before Paul said that. It was so funny.
Right?
What? You couldn't have told me this yesterday. You couldn't have told me this yesterday. Anyway, sorry, you said that. And my brain flashes to Babylon Bee.
I think it's so profound, though, because understanding that they, but he goes into something that I think is really brilliant on the second part about recognition of the foundation of the Jewish state or Israel being very secular in its essence and separate from the Jewish religion. And I think it's really kind of important even to look at Zionism in that way as well. And he names some of the founders, and he really brings us. It's when you read.
Oh, I can't wait till Ignatius gets
Benedict's
this out
letter.
In English.
It's
oh,
so good.
Well, and it's so good. Bree, the nature of your work and my work, we're really privileged that you're living in Rome as a correspondent for Daily Wire, that we have to talk to people who are Muslims or Jewish who are really committed to their faith and their culture and their tradition, as we are. And how do you maintain relationships when you have all of this colliding along with history, right? Our different beliefs and history, and it's colliding. And then here you have two men having this intimate, this conversation.
Like a conversation, like a civil discourse.
Not virtue signaling, not hiding from the truth, not hiding from history or theology, but trying to talk to each other in the midst of engaging all of that.
Exactly. And that's the point I think I was making earlier with regards to being ethical as a journalist, is that if you believe in ethics, if you believe in truth, then you walk the walk and you talk the talk, because really people are going to look to you. Like it or not, that people place you in a position where you have influence. And so it is to whom much is given, much is expected, as our Lord said. And I think that's also the case when it comes to engaging with, these other faiths, is that at that point, at that very moment that you're engaging with them, you are representative of the faith, right? And there's so many Christians, so many Christians that I've come across in the last, and Catholics, I'm being part of this, but so many Christians I've come across who are part of some very influential movements, you know, whether it's in media, whether it's, you know, a certain production on the life of Jesus, whatever. There are so many Christians that behind the scenes are utterly ruthless, are do not live the faith at all. And even when people who are in trouble, people who are suffering of their own faith, they turn their backs on them. And so imagine being that as the representative to another faith. You know, how do you even begin to have a dialogue? How does anybody take you seriously?
Yeah, you know, so you're a journalist, right? Point. If you misquote me or mistranslate me, that's calumny and detraction all rolled into one.
Right.
I mean, it's disgusting. Right. Why do that? Why don't you just go to Madison Avenue and make some real money selling Coca-Cola?
Yeah, I mean, truly.
Right? I mean, right? Why be a journalist if you're going to make stuff up? Be an ad sales.
Right. And then people will say, the response will be, Jason, well, the other side does it. Well, we believe ends don't justify means. So try again. You know, like, you can't do but whatever, or like, you know, whataboutisms. Like, that doesn't work in this case. And I think Pope Benedict is a perfect example in his correspondence. Like, he goes into detail about, you know, the sex abuse crisis. Look at, like, I'm with people when they say, he was Pope. He could have done something about it. I can't go into why his intentions, like what happened there. I can't. But what I can say is that reading what he talks about based off of what he had said publicly, especially really at the beginning of his pontificate, when he said, pray that I do not flee for, you know, as the shepherd, that I don't flee the wolves. I think what we saw was a very serious, like, he goes into depth, especially in the United States.
So he's challenging himself. Is he saying that he fled the wolves?
I fear, he doesn't come out and say it, but I fear that when he talks about why we saw sex abuse and pedophilia in this book, and this is like a, you know, I believe Catholic.
Wow.
News agency put out the unofficial transcript of this particular part of the book, because it was a speech he had made earlier. He discussed these homosexual cliques, for example, that were building up, that had infiltrated the seminaries in the United States. And they were being built up by other bishops. And we know about this stuff already. We know it because of McCarrick. We knew this when McCarrick was still kingmaker.
But here's the point, Bree. But here's the point, Bree, on that. By the way, John Zmierich wrote an article, and John and I argued about it passionately on the phone. Where his article was, Daddy went for cigarettes and never came back. Sounds like Bennett kind of agrees with that take. But here's the point. Bree, when I came to D.C. in 2000, and I was here 2000, 2001, 2002, I was not Catholic, but I was pro-life, worked for a pro-life organization. All my friends worked for the church at the USCCB, everywhere. All they would talk about at the bars was McCarrick pervert stories.
Yeah.
So you can't tell me 22-year-old kids from Steubenville who are pouring coffee at the USCCB told me, I think in like 2002... stories about McCarrick with the 12 beds and the 13 seminarians at his retreat house. And you know what? People giggled about it. I was an atheist. I'm just like,
what the?
Yeah. But you know, but the truth is I wasn't that shocked. I'm like, okay, grown men are being perverts. I'm not Catholic. Whatever. It's not like they're children. And so I didn't say stop the presses. I didn't go, you know what I mean? I just thought like, gross. But you can't tell me every bishop in this country didn't know. Prominent philanthropists that supported the church. You can't tell me the biggest conservative donors of the church didn't know. So we can't blame Pope Benedict.
Right.
We all are responsible.
I think really you've hit the nail on the head. Because first off, if you know the situation with John Paul II and Pope Benedict, and Pope Benedict being over the CDF, Pope Benedict knew about this when he was Ratzinger. He saw all of this stuff at the CDF. So he was very reluctant. He wanted to retire with his brother And this, I did an interview just recently, an exclusive with a very close friend of both Benedict and his brother Georg. He wanted to retire with his brother to Bavaria in a monastery and continue to like pray and contemplate until his death. That's what he wanted. He asked Pope John Paul II to be able to do so. Pope John Paul II said no. He needed him here. And then John Paul II dies years later. This was years later. This wasn't like right before his death. This is years later that Pope John Paul II dies. And Benedict is elevated. And Benedict, he reluctantly took this position. If you knew him as a person, Benedict is so painfully introverted. Like, this was not this role that he was walking in after the big charismatic John Paul II was incredibly painful for him and scary. And it was scary because he had made enemies as CDF of all of these people, and McCarrick was gunning for him.
And they're vicious. And McCarrick had the CCP as his friend. Let's just be honest. Yep. The Communist Party of China, with its vast intelligence networks, was on the side of McCarrick. And meanwhile, this new story leaked that someone from the CIA or NSA told somebody the day that Pope Benedict was elevated, Cardinal Ratzinger was elevated, he'll have to resign.
Oh, I mean,
did you see that story?
I did not, but I will tell you that the intelligence agencies are alive and well here in Rome. And that's all I can say about that. But I can tell you that with regards to CCP, I think your listeners need to go back and take a look. There were shadows of reports that occurred. It was like a blip on the radar that right before the second renewal of the CCP, the secret deal with China, between the Vatican, right before that second renewal, it was just 1 year, came out a report from the United States that said that the CCP had, state hackers had hacked into the Vatican. Okay. So anybody who understands how the CCP works, they work with money, they work with sex and manipulation, and they work with power and control. And usually they come to the table with money and power options. And usually they come to the table again with sex exploitation or blackmail. And they seem to, this came at a very similar time, or shortly, maybe within a few months afterwards, came the reports out of the pillar that ended up being hush-hush and going nowhere, on certain apps that had been hacked into and identified priests actively trolling, sex hookup sites, homosexually mostly.
Yeah.
So I bring this up to the forefront because the CCP and the deal with the Vatican has been essentially broken in the last few months by the Chinese communists. They agreed with the Vatican, and what we know with the Sino-Vatican deal, they agreed with the Vatican that they would not, the patriotic church would not elect and elevate bishops on their own, that the Vatican would take their, representatives would take their particular requests into consideration, that the Vatican would be the ones to elevate bishops, right? Well, the CCP just ordained a whole bunch of patriotic church bishops
without the Holy Father's permission. Yeah, unbelievable.
Exactly.
Need a synod on perversity. Listen, this is my idea. This is like coming out of the Aryan heresy. We've had the KGB, now Russian intelligence, the CIA, the CCP, running roughshod over the church. It was what Bela Dodd said in 1950, 3,000 homosexual men had been already put into the seminaries, communists, by 1951. Well, that was an exaggeration, or who knows? But McCarrick went from being a Marxist communist kid and then came home one day and told his parents he was going to be the first American pope.
Right.
So there's that. But we just need to say we are coming out of a strange 100 years. And a lot of people got swept away and a lot of not. But just wash it away.
Found it very difficult.
How? And he's an old guy.
Church and united. And he was trying to unite the church. I mean, really, we had just lost one of the greatest popes in our, considered one of the greatest popes in our age. And he was stepping into very large shoes, and he understood all of the nature behind the scenes of what was happening, especially in the United States. And I do believe that from the get-go, Pope Benedict saw this as detrimental to his own salvation to take the role on as Pope, because of everything that was going on in the church. And I think that he made up in his mind, and I think there are people who would confirm this, the role of this emeritus bishop, being that reflective of the bishops emeritus or emeriti, rather, in dioceses throughout the United States and throughout the world. You know, they are there like Cardinal Zen. They have authority to speak and to write, but they're not running a diocese, right? And I think Pope Benedict has made it clear through several of his writings or interviews with Peter Sewald that was his intent as well, that that's what a Pope Emeritus would be, one that would remain as like a spiritual authority, but no longer take active role in the head of it. But there's no, from time in memoriam, there is no evidence of a precedence in that. So he set a precedence that now Pope Francis is having to address over and over again. Is he going to resign? Has he thought of making this a permanent thing?
Pope Francis
has made it really clear. Well, he's made it clear that he doesn't believe it should be a permanent thing. He's not even put his head to the thought of making it a permanent thing. And that if he resigns, which he said, you know, would happen in case that he became immobile or like medically unable to do so, if he was to resign, that he would go and live with like and be expected to live as a priest in the retirement home of priests in Rome. He came out and said that with the AP recently. So I think it's really important to say, also another thing, too, just kind of on this thread. Talking about the Pope's health, he did come out and make a little bit more of a statement with regards to his health. So he had fractures in his knee that he said have been healed based off of some massive therapy. He didn't want to go under the knife again because he had a really bad reaction. He admitted this in previous interviews. He had a really bad interaction or reaction to the medication that they gave him,
anesthesia.
And to the anesthesia. Yeah. So he didn't want to go under the knife again. So he went through and he said that his fractures in his knee have healed. However, he also has additional comorbidities, including the diverticulitis, I think that's what you call it, from his colon. And he said those have returned. Mm. So it seems like he's having additional bowel issues, and who knows what that means.
Well, let's move away from it. I don't want to talk about his bowels. Let's talk about.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, so. No, I don't. No, that's okay. it's too close to home when you're talking about bowel issues. I don't want to talk about it. So, I want to get into some of maybe two more points that because I've already taken an hour of your time, two more points that you want to share from the book.
Right.
But also here's a question before I forget it. Not to compare Pope Benedict to Prince, Prince from Minnesota, the musician, not Prince Harry or whatever his name is. When he passed away, they said there's basically 27 albums of music left unpublished. Pope Benedict writes a lot. He just writes and writes and writes. Is it going to be like the Prince catalog? Is there going to be book after book after book after book, or is this it?
I think he did have like a. I think he had stated to certain individuals to hold back on printing some of these works until after his death, he actually said that in, he had said, it's like third hand knowledge here, because we get from the beginning of the book, but he does say that after the debacle that took place between Cardinal Seurat, and there's a little bit more in detail on what happened there, but between Cardinal Seurat and the Vatican, after Seurat posted that or published that book on his book with his letter, Pope Benedict's letter inside it as well, on the papacy and celibacy, that he said, I have too many, and this is where I'm saying, like, when it comes to Pope Benedict saying, pray for me so that I do not flee the wolves, because he says, I'm done. I don't want to publish anything more publicly because of the vicious enemies I have, especially in Germany. I just don't want it. So don't publish anything until after my death. That is nearly verbatim what he said to the co-author of this particular book. So there is, to answer your question, I do believe there is another book that has come out either today or will be coming out this week in Italian as well.
Wait, there's another book? Book two is already out?
I don't believe this is me coming from recent, okay, like, connections from a journalist here in Rome.
So it's not published, but it's been released and sent to a publisher.
I think it's, well, no. I believe it's come out. Whoa. I think John Allen made it clear it was coming out in Italian today, but I'm not 100% sure. That is something that we'll have to go back on. I don't have I don't have the copy of the book, and it's supposedly like certain quotes and correspondence, but it isn't by him. It's by another author.
Okay. Is this the book by his, I don't want to say chief of staff, but his secretary.
Oh, nope, not his secretary. Okay. This is another book. This is the third book. I think it.
There was a friend who said he had some shocking letters. There's some, yes, a friend that said he has shocking letters he's going to publish, and people are like, when are you going to publish them? Is it that book?
I believe it is that book, and I believe I've seen the picture of the, I believe, like, John, again, I'm quoting from a video I saw from John Allen yesterday, okay, where he's talking about the different books that are coming out and that he hadn't read this book yet. But it is about, I believe, Pope Benedict choosing to leave.
That's the one. I've been wanting to read, mm-hmm, that letter. We've been hearing about that letter.
Right.
Before you get to your points, right, I want to make this point before I forget to all the Catholic laity listening. This is the point. That here you had Pope Benedict, Cardinal Ratzinger, terrified because he was surrounded by vicious vipers. They didn't look scary. They have string bean arms, pasty skin. They are effeminate and they lisp and they gaslight you and they dissemble every sentence. But when you are a Catholic donor, when you are a powerful and influential Catholic layperson, they fear us. They, right, can't hurt us. But they can bully seminarians, molest them, like McCarrick. They can conspire and leak to the press and partner with intelligence agencies, like McCarrick obviously did, to wage a war against a man. And so that's why it is our responsibility as Catholic laymen. And I, as an American Catholic layman, I'm like, I should be your worst nightmare, whoever you are. Because I'm a free citizen in the Catholic Church. I'm coming for you. There's nothing we can't do. So this is the point, that we should not let our priests, our bishops, or our pope be terrorized by, let's call what it is. It is the Lavender Mafia.
Right.
And you don't have to agree with that, but that's what it is. And I'm not one to be sensational.
Well, they call themselves that. So I think it's really important.
Wow, they call themselves that.
That's why we have, why it's called the Lavender Mafia.
Wow.
That they named themselves. Now, there is a video. You have to search deeply for it. But the cardinal who died a few years ago out of, out of Bavaria, out of Brussels. He was caught up with a whole bunch of sex scandal as well. I'm going to try to look up his name, but he did a video where he literally talked, like he goes out and he talks about this at length, about how this group who they called the lab, they called themselves the Lavender Mafia, were essentially,
They never get caught with women either, because women are too scary for them. It's always there. It's always with other members of their mafia that are more feminine than women, because women are women scare them. They'll never be caught with women are too scary for them. That's not going to happen. It's just with other members of the Teletubby Lavender Mafia.
It's just interesting because he talks about specifically their work behind the scenes at the last conclave to promote Bergoglio, now Pope Francis. He took a lot of responsibility in Glee, and it was echoed later by McCarrick as well. So in a public statement, which you can find as well. So there is truth to that. But I would have to say, Jason, that there have been certain book and vlogger influencers who've really taken this to a next level, and who have not fact-checked, who have not provided facts, who really instead provided their narrative based off of really manipulating crises in the church. And I think we have to be really aware of that, because it's one of the things that really bugs me about, and I'm going to just bring him up, about the Vigano controversies, is that, Vigano was the nuncio in Washington, D.C. when all of this sex abuse stuff was popping up. He knew about sex abuse. And it was only after the 2018 grand jury report, Pennsylvania grand jury report, that he came out and started pointing at others in the church. But he first started taking responsibility. He started off saying, well, I knew about it, and I'm going to see my maker soon, and so I have to be honest. And there was credibility in that. But after that, he didn't provide any evidence that he claimed he had against these other people that he started to malign. And the problem with Vigano is that soon after, it became apparent that there were certain journalists who were really manipulating Vigano in order to push crises manipulation and make money. And then right after that, evidence popped up that Vigano had hired a sex abuser, like a prior priest who was laicized. And his name's Peter Mitchell, and it's been covered very, very quickly out of only one outlet, Catholic Herald, did an actual investigative report on this. And the other Catholic media didn't even touch it, because ends again justify the means. And it's not worth it, because Vigano supposedly is, quote, on our side. But I want you to sit back for a second, for those who listen to Jason's podcast, and know how much Jason works for people who are caught in the middle of conflict, and ask yourself, is it really a black and white thing where you have someone from the church now pointing to other people in the church and caught hiring someone who was involved in the sex abuse crisis that he was supposed to be the whistleblower on?
Yeah, no, I didn't even know about that. And I'm going to challenge you on this, Bree. I don't think they're doing it for money, because I don't think there's money to be made in the space that those people live. I mean, there's not that much money to be made.
Manipulators make a lot of money.
If they're selling in Ukraine or Afghanistan, maybe if you're a military contractor. I just don't know if these apostolates are making money. I think it's something even worse than that. It's the attraction. There's just a strange attraction to the darkness. It's an easier narrative, right? So what interests me most in all of this is how it, especially the McCarrick thing, is how does it bump up against national security? You have the cardinal in D.C. Is he hearing the confession of someone on the Senate Intelligence Committee? Right. And where is our FBI in all of this? If I was a member of Congress, I wouldn't confess to any priest in Washington, D.C. I'm telling you right now, and I definitely wouldn't confess to a cardinal. I would go to Idaho on a pit stop and I'd run into a little country parish because I honestly, I don't even want to say out loud what I'm saying, but you know what I'm saying. Well, can you imagine if Ted Kennedy's senators like, you know, Cardinal McCarrick, he's heard members of Congress's confessions. He's heard high-ranking FBI, NSA, who, if you imagine you're a Catholic, you're in D.C., you're a big shot, Cardinal McCarrick's your friend, he comes over, hey, can you hear my confession? This stuff horrifies me because this is the stuff that interests me, not their perversity. It's how their perversity let them open to, how is it that the mystical body of Christ has been not only utterly silent, not one word from Pope Francis, not one word from Pope Francis on the Uyghur, ever, never. I know. Said the word. He wrote it once.
Or the Hong Kong, or the those who suffered in, under Hong the persecution in Hong Kong. Like you mentioned, I had conversations with prior executive level at Apple Daily, journalists who are now in exile, and I've asked them, what can we do as journalists? What can I do? Because there, no one's speaking up for them. And these are Catholics. Many of them are Catholics. And I'm just why I sit there, and this is why your apostolate is so vital, Jason. It's so vital, and I think people realize this, is that you guys go to places in the world like Mother Teresa did, where most people can't, and help individuals where most people would like to, but don't ever have that chance. For some reason, God has given you these massive gifts in order to be able to open these doors. And similar, you know, points that you are making with regards to just the corruption in the church, you know, you're 100% right. There are connections. It's like a hand. There are connections between the entertainment industry, the political industry, the education industry, the military industrial complex, and politics and church. That you can't divide them.
We can't be naive, you know? Right? We would want to pretend that that's just not the case. That's just not the case. But we absolutely know it's the case.
Right.
And the good news is the CCP is teetering. I cannot wait. Like, we had the Verona documents when the Soviet Union fell.
Right.
And remember, we had most people listening won't know this, but you'll know this. Like in Poland, it was really hard for the church to go through and discover how many priests and bishops were working for the KGB, working for.
Oh yeah.
We're going when the CCP falls, we're going to be shocked at how deep their tentacles were inside the church in the United States.
Right.
It's going to be just mind blowing. And you know, we believe when we watch the Jason Bourne movies. Oh, but then when in real life, we're like, oh, come on. That's not going on. 100, of course it's going on.
Well, I will say this, Jason, something that was told to me by a source. The Vatican has been known to have one of the highest, most effective, state-of-the-art intelligence gathering services in the entire history of in the intel community. When, I'll give you an example that is public, when Reagan was coordinating with Margaret Thatcher. There's a book out actually called The President, the Pope, and the Prime Minister. He came upon some information that he wanted his intelligence service to communicate to the Pope. And this information was highly classified and urgent. And so an agent out of the embassy was able to go through channels at the Stato, at the Secretary of State, reportedly. And when he sat down to speak with Stato and the Pope, Stato stopped the agent mid-sentence and said, "Oh yes, Your Holiness, we already discussed this."
Well,
they had it before the U.S. had it, and it had to deal with certain elements in the USSR. So I'm just saying.
But those were the good old days, right?
Potentially. I mean, we don't know. Like, I can tell you this, like, you can go to the state here and you can talk to individuals at the Vatican Secretariat of State. But we have seen through, at least through the recent trial of Cardinal Becciu, who was number two at one point at the Stato, or number three rather, number two. He had to go through loopholes in order to even kind of declassify for this particular trial, the Vatican's involvement in negotiations for the release of a nun who had been taken captive. So I do believe they are still very active.
Okay, good. I do know that when I was trying to rescue some nuns and priests from Afghanistan and the U.S. balked at it, and this is crazy. We literally had a military unit that supposedly doesn't exist, that doesn't officially exist in the United States. I was on the phone with their commanders. They were in the helicopter to go get these nuns in Afghanistan. Then they were told to stand down.
Right.
But then out of the blue, Spain, Italy, and Germany, some of their units contacted us on the ground from Afghanistan and said they were ready to go, and then the Italians went and got them. So I just don't know who is communicating with who, how they got my number. But
Special forces are fun in that way. I can't go into detail, but I also help support getting, because you and I both were prior military, so I can speak to this a bit. I had still very good friends who are active duty, and some of their interpreters right at the early days of all of this were caught, and they were rescued through contacts in the State Department. So it is something that was being coordinated kind of.
It was unofficial networks. These were all lay Catholics.
Yep, that's exactly.
My wife was like in my office going, "Who are you?" She's like, "Who are you?" I said, I don't know what's going on here. It's just one guy gives my number. The other guy, like, "Where are these nuns?"
Right.
We'll go get them if the U.S. won't get them. And I leaked the story. Yeah. You know, the U.S. didn't want it to be known that the Italians got. I'll tell you, I'm the guy that leaked the story to the Catholic News Agency. But whatever. I wanted to embarrass the U.S. Yes. So, okay, let's. I could talk to you forever. You got to be a regular on my show if that's okay.
I would be happy. You know, I don't do it often with most media, but when it comes to you and your mission, I'm right there alongside you. I do appreciate just the mission of human persons, you know, and taking care of the most vulnerable. So, yes.
Well, and this is your home, because this podcast is, so when I started this podcast, the goal was to find my tribe. And I'm like, I don't know if it's 2 people or 100 people. We have never spent advertising on this show. And there are weeks, we've made it to the top 20 podcast in America some weeks. Amazing. We hover in the top 200. If I do one show a week, we'll hover top 200. 2 shows a week, we'll get the top 100. But what makes that to me so amazing is it is literally just our tribe. Like, everyone listening is our tribe, except there is a guy who listens that works for Alan Guttmacher Institute, a kid. He has to take notes, see what I'm saying. And then there's the guy from the CCP, and then the guy now from Azerbaijan and Turkey. So we have a few of those guys, and they take notes. That's good for them. It's a good job. But it's our tribe. And again, I do touch on a lot of controversy. I hope I'm always fair. And I don't want to, I'm not interested in, you know, when I have an article that should be dropping right now responding to the founder of Dilbert, the writer, the guy, the Dilbert guy, who came out and said, good for you, you anti-vaxxers, you won. You were smart. We were stupid. And he's being sincere. And we made a big mistake and you were the smart ones. And I have an article responding to him saying, actually, we're losers. We're not. He kept saying, you're the winners. No, we lose. We lost too, because I give all the reasons why we lost too. But when I got, I was the first guy in the world arrested leading an anti-COVID lockdown protest. And I said, look it to my team, we're not going to become the anti-lockdown podcast. I'm not going to become the anti-vax show. We're not, you know, it's just going to be the Jason Jones show, because we need to stay focused. I do not want to, and we need to push back on these COVID policies that are causing famine and suicides and destroying children. But we're not going to grow the show around that. We're going to grow the
around
show.
Around crises.
We're going to grow it slowly. organically, because I don't want the biggest audience in the world. I want my tribe. And I think a lot of the key members of my tribe are going to go, Jason's becoming that guy, you know? And so it's just going to be the show. And I don't want to engage in calumny. I don't want to, and you know, it is like you said, well, they do it to us, we're going to do it to them. Of course, there are times it is very tempting to take a cheap shot at someone who's been taking cheap shots at you relentlessly.
Right.
But the main reason I don't isn't cause out of morals. It's because I want to be trusted over a long period of time.
Exactly.
If I thought I could gaslight and do cheap shots and you all still trust me for decades, I would do it maybe, you know, but I just know that sooner or later you're going to go, oh yeah, you can't trust Jason. He's taking, you know, I don't know when he's taking cheap shots or clean shots, but he's always just trying to push the ball forward for his agenda. Right. I don't want to do that.
Exactly. And, you know, and that's something that is extremely important to me as well. Like people ask me, why are you in journalism? And it happened that I kind of was thrust into this world, but I had been working in journalism when I was active duty, Jason, and I saw it from the other side. I actually saw what PSYOPs does. I know how it works. And so I went into journalism with eyes very wide open to how the narrative is manipulated and how far we've gone from holding people accountable to ethics. But what I didn't expect, Jason, was to find it so strongly on the side that's supposedly fighting for truth. And what really kills me is to see, you know, my fellow Americans manipulated because there's a crisis going on, like you say, with COVID. And then someone says, oh, I can actually make money off of this crisis on the right by pushing some truth and a whole lot of conspiracy. And people will buy it because, oh, the government's going to attack us, right? And we're victims. And so it's like really mixed up, very difficult way to navigate through all the disinformation and the exploitation and opportunism that we find in the media. And I'm one person and I don't hold myself up on a standard other than ethics and serving the truth, Jesus. I do this because is a mission that I've been given. That's it. And when he says done, I'm done. But until that time, I'm willing to stand up for truth and facts. And I think that's my mission. But I look to your mission and I say, your mission is so important. And they walk hand in hand because we're both serving the truth and we're both serving the truth for justice. And for people who don't know how to or don't have the ability to speak out. So I am honored to be on this podcast and I thank you for that. And I'm happy to come on again and talk all sorts of shop as much.
Well,
as
no, and we're going to have to do another show on this book. We'll let you read the next two books, this book and the next book. We'll have you back on. And again, I want to push back on one thing. I don't think they're doing it for money on our side because I just don't think there's that much money. I think they've just become so abused and they don't trust anything and they'll believe anything, which leads them to believe crazy things. So like that's how you got this QAnon phenomenon, right? Like it was just dumb, just bizarre.
By the end, it was really stupid. And yet certain journalists out of Rome were the ones to report first off that the Vatican had gone dark and like the Pope may have been arrested. Like that whole scenario.
I forgot. It can't keep up with it. I forgot.
That came from Q.
Is this a fake Pope? Oh, so this is a fake Pope. Like we have a fake time.
What's it? The level of, but you start from truth, you know?
Tom Hanks is fake, right? Tom Hanks is fake. The Pope is fake. They're artificial. Yeah, no.
I remember asking someone, Jason, I remember asking someone as a military officer, right? I said, okay, so let's just put this as in perspective. Who do you think could actually enter a sovereign country and arrest the Pope? By what law? And the person came back and said, well, the United States.
Yeah, it was
would be an act of
General war. Flynn and Donald Trump flew in on the Batmobile or whatever. No, it's so weird. I mean, I some people that are kind of sophisticated. I had a friend that worked in the intelligence community who believed this, and I love the guy. And I'm like, bro, come on.
Bro, right?
Bro,
yeah.
But you know what it is? You're just so in it. And I said, first of all, when they say white hats and black hats, you know, they're not telling the truth because there's no white hats and black hats. There's gray hats. You don't even have on a white hat. So if you think you have a white hat on, you better look again, right? So it was just, yeah, and that's, it's just so sad. But I don't think anybody was making money off of that. I just think they're just beaten. They're confused. And it is scary.
You and I will have to, we'll have to talk about that offhand. But, oh, yes, there's money involved in this. There's always money in crises, whether it's from the left or the right. There's always money in crises and information control and narratives. Always.
Well, let's do a show one day on who made money off of Q. Because that just scares me. You know,
yes, we can.
I went on Alex Jones's show 3 years ago. I went on Alex Jones's show 3 years ago when I heard about this Q. And I said, Alex, can I go on your show and tell your audience 4 steps to knowing Q's a fraud? And I did this whole 4 steps to knowing Q's a fraud. And then this whole like subculture is obsessed with me being like an Illuminati Jesuit super troll, super plant.
Awesome.
I think I drive a better car.
Well,
if I was an Illuminati Jesuit, I guarantee you Father Martin has a better car than me, James Martin.
Probably.
Miralis is in the background. I know he lives in like Park Avenue.
She's like, stop. Miralis is like, no more.
No, she says she's seen his car. It's nicer than mine. But I have a Toyota Tacoma 2015, which is just a pretty darn good truck. I guarantee you that you cannot haul stuff to the dump like I have to with 7 kids every week because they only give me 1 garbage can, Bree.
Right.
And then I have to go to the dump every week.
I have a Jeep Wrangler in Rome. I just want to say, Jeep Wrangler.
Does it have a MAGA bumper sticker?
No, the MAGA bumper sticker that I have been given, which was not a MAGA bumper sticker, it was a another type of, in that genre, was given to a certain cafe owner. Marilis knows. Certain cafe owner
in Rome. Marilis knows. I'll get the scoop.
Has now this displayed on his coffee maker, and it's caused an uproar amongst certain journalists in Rome.
I love it.
A lot of journos go there.
I'm going to go there next time I'm in Rome. You have to take me there.
You're going to be looking for it.
No, but you, okay, you are an all-American girl driving a Jeep Wrangler around Rome. You need a bumper sticker that just says America.
I do have an American bumper sticker on there. It's just the flag.
Okay.
And I do have a window decal of the Miraculous Medal.
Well, that's awesome.
That's all I have.
So that's but that fits in Rome. I mean, that you can have that, but with the American flag, I think that's awesome. Are you living the dream? Is this? I mean, I have to imagine as a journalist.
It was my dream.
In Rome.
It was my dream.
This is the dream, right?
It was a once in a lifetime opportunity, and it was my dream. I had been visiting Rome multiple times throughout the course of my active duty time and everything like that, because I've always felt like Rome was home to me. And it just ended up that I came across, at the time of COVID, just the best opportunity. And I took it, sold my house, sold everything, and that's what I did. So, yes, I am living the dream.
Now, let me ask you this, the last question. But you got to tell me the truth. Have you seen two guys, they go by the names Elijah and Enoch, walking around? I think they're there right now. I'm just worried. Will you come on my show? If you see two old Jewish guys in like sackcloth preaching the gospel, will you call me?
I will tell you, I was walking down with my friend, the historian out of Germany, a very famous historian, Michael, and I were walking our dogs down by Campo dei Fiori, and we met up with two very old Jewish men who were asking directions.
Oh, no. Did you guys joke that was Elijah and Enoch?
No, well, we didn't, but I probably should have made the connection, but now you're making me think.
Wait, where were they going?
To be considered.
Where were they
going? They were headed over towards the Vatican.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Was it before?
And I told them good Sabbath. And they were like, good Sabbath, because it was on the Sabbath. It was the eve of
they weren't
Sabbath,
like, so. This city's changed in the past 3,000 years.
they didn't say that to me, but I'm not sure if they
would. It's good to be back on Earth. Okay, I hope somebody gets the joke. I just think they're coming. I keep looking out
Book
for
of
them.
Book of Revelation.
Yeah, Book of Revelations. These two guys are coming back. If you see them, go to confession right away. All right, Bree. I think
Go to confession right away anyway.
That's true. That's true. Don't go to McCarrick. So I just want to say, this is a typical Jason Jones show. I don't even think we talked about what the heck I was supposed to have you on. We did a little.
We hit the book a little bit.
We hit the book a little. All right, we're going to have you back on. Marilis and I are now going to have lunch with the former president of Mongolia. This is just our day.
That's amazing.
Right now.
I want to hear about his new cardinal, in Mongolia. I want to hear all about him.
Okay, Marilis, we have to ask about the new cardinal in Mongolia. Yeah. Well, VPP is starting to open up. We're going to be opening up a school in Mongolia this year.
Oh, cool.
And it is pretty cool, right?
Yeah.
And
I've been there.
I've never been. I can't wait. I'm hoping to go this year.
Get ready. It's astonishing.
Yeah, it just looks like the most beautiful place on earth.
And the people are, it's just so unique. It really is like stepping back in time.
Well, so that's our next meeting. Last night we had, did she tell you about our dinner last night?
No.
Our buddy Ryan Hendrickson is a Green Beret. He had his leg blown off in Afghanistan. Then after 26 surgeries, it was reattached. Then he went and did 6 more tours as a Green Beret in Afghanistan.
Why
after
not?
Having his legs blown off. Yeah, right. Why not?
Why not?
And then he retired after the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan. He was there till the day of the withdrawal, and then he retired. And he was just so depressed at what we did to Afghanistan, he wanted to be of use. So he went to as soon as Russia invaded Ukraine, he went to Ukraine. Then he's been working with us. Mm-hmm. We partnered with him to begin removing landmines. But he was in D.C. for a meeting with some landmine removal manufacturer, guy that manufactures devices used to remove landmines. And we were all in town together. So he and a firefight, I believe, in 2016, pulled his Afghan buddy, who'd been shot 6 times, to safety. And now his buddy with his kids live in D.C. area. So Ryan and I, Marilis, and my wife and all my children, we went and had this wonderful Afghan dinner with these war heroes, these Afghan war heroes, this Army Green Beret hero. And my daughters played with his daughters, so they're about the same age. My son is the same age as his young son, my youngest son. And it was just one of those beautiful evenings, you know, where we were in the presence of greatness. And just kind
it's
of
always fun to get veterans together with veterans, right?
I mean, it
really is. Like, it's, people don't quite understand it here because it's such a different culture in Italy where the brotherhood does not exist. Potentially perhaps through like some of the police organizations there it does, but it's very muted compared to how our brotherhood is. But once you're in, you know, and you've seen the things that you've seen, like you were talking about, well, you know, he pulled his buddy out, he got shot 6 times. We're just like, oh yeah,
right.
That's pretty. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like it's not that, you know, but the concept, we know the concept, we've lived in it, but it's kind of hard to convey that reality unless you've been there. So that brotherhood is really formed in the trenches. And so, yeah, I've been very honored to be able to serve my country in that way. And it sounds like it would have been a very cool conversation.
Well, and you know, you're much younger than me. In my generation, I think 1% of men or 3% of men were veterans. No, I'm sorry. 3% of men were in uniform at any given time. So there were a lot of folks were veterans. Now, I mean, I can
1%.
Yeah, you don't meet
about
veterans.
1%.
You don't meet veterans. Yep. I remember as a kid, you'd be in an event and they'd say, if you're a veteran, stand up, and every man in the room would stand up. Now I'm at conservative events in Washington, D.C., and I was like, if you're a veteran, stand up, and I'm the only one standing up. And you're like, this is so strange. So it is, it is,
1% of, and then like when you're, you know, an officer, then it's a very small percent of that 1%. And then you're a female officer and you're a very, you know, so you start to say, wow, like I actually broke through multiple molds in order to stand. And people, I experienced a lot. Like I have no problem talking to people who have PTS because I also have suffered through PTS. And people say, like, would you go back? Would you do it again? Even knowing the things that you saw and what you've experienced and the, you know, walking wounds that you have. And I have said, absolutely, hands down, yes. Absolutely, hands down, yes, I would do it again. I'm proud of what I earned. You know, I earned these stripes, as we say. So it's like one of those things, like when you meet another military veteran that you kind of can breathe a little bit of a sigh of a relief, you know, and just be like, oh, you know, buddy. I mean, they're like, yeah, you know, too. And it's like, yeah, that's all you have to really say, you know?
So yeah, no, it's
true. It was a nice experience.
It was beautiful. And it was good for my children to see, because this Afghan man is a paraplegic. So he's still in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. It was still in a wheelchair. You know, he's in a wheelchair. And then my friend who had his leg blown off. So my sons, to just, I could see they were taking it in. They were looking at them and kind of seeing the cost of service up close. And they were listening to the conversations about, sadly, we were talking about how many of our friends have committed suicide since the U.S. withdrawal. Since the U.S. withdrawal. And I will say that is what drove me. My best friend was blown up in Afghanistan and survived, but you know, it was horribly damaging to him. And he was a very strong, independent man. And now he has PTSD induced seizures. So he can't really travel freely as much as he did before. And a lot of limitations. And for a guy like that, it's just strange. And probably that was the number one thing that was motivating me for the first 9 months, was just to salvage just some of their sacrifice, to do what I could. I felt like the Biden administration was carrying this treasure of 20 years of blood, of lives, of broken families and sons and daughters who didn't really get to know their fathers and mothers, and, you know, 13-month deployments. So all this treasure was and then the Biden administration just kicked it all away. And I feel like what I'm just trying to do is I'm running around trying to pick up this sack, these gold coins that represent the sacrifice of countless men and women who served, American and Afghan, and just trying to save them, you know, just trying to save it. And that's really probably what motivated me, until I just woke up one day and realized I'm in love with the people of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, it's so amazing to see the development of your work and you know, working in pro-life and then really putting that mindset where a lot of people would argue pro-life activists don't go, which is the entire whole of humanity, not just, you know, babies are super important and we have to promote the pro-life message of, you know, the intrinsic value of every human life from conception to natural death. But there's a whole span of lifetime between those two points, right? And you have really taken up the pro-life cause in the sense of the most vulnerable people, the displaced people, the people in the in-between, you know, so...
Well,
love it.
Well, Bree, thank you. I have a guy that listens to this show, and every time guests say nice things about me, he goes, "You just love when they say nice things about you and let them go." I'm going to cut you off right there. So Angus doesn't send me an email about how you let your guests go on and on about how great you are. So Bree, enough of that.
okay.
But Bree, hey, well, you're welcome back anytime. Marilis has given me that we're about to be late for our lunch, and you need to shave, look, because I've been doing interviews since 7 a.m. Bree Dale from the Daily Wire, how big is that? Rome correspondent, and I'm going to have all of your contact, your page at the Daily Wire, everything in the show notes, and I look forward to seeing you soon and having you back on the show sooner.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me.
All right. God bless. I'm going to sell pillows now.
Bye-bye.
That was the great Bree Dale, Daily Wire. What's that? Well, I'm still on the air, Marilis. She said, that's one of my favorite interviews. I'm still on the air, Marilis. No one asked you your opinion. So I'm trying to sell pillows over here. So that was Bree from the Daily Wire, Rome correspondent. We're going to we'll let Daily Wire pay her, but we'll have her on enough that she'll basically be like our, how about that, Marilis? She'll be our Rome correspondent too, even though Marilis is in Rome usually as well. I'm not trying to take your job, Marilis, but that was a great interview. Unfortunately, I didn't do my job and asked. I allowed myself to get distracted. We talked a bit about the book, probably could have talked about the book more. But anyways, this episode is being brought to you by the world's greatest all-American pillow. We need to send Brie a great American pillow because they have better spaghetti and bread over there. But I bet you in Rome, they don't have Mike Lindell's My Pillow, but you can have it, guys, by going to MyPillow.com, using the code Jones. You get the Giza Dream sheets. You get the mattress topper. You get the pillow. And Mike has extended his biggest discounts ever because he's being deplatformed. And because he's being deplatformed everywhere, and he's now in these box stores, it's giving him the opportunity to actually increase his online sales through partnering with shows like mine, and he can give you better deals. So go to MyPillow.com, use the code Jones, and get all your pillows, your slippers, your bathrobes, your mattress. Even though if you wear a bathrobe, you're a weirdo. But if you're a weirdo who likes bathrobes, Mike Lindell goes, bathrobes are the best. MyPillow.com, code is Jones. And if you want to stay free, you need to stay informed. The best newspaper in the world is the Epoch Times. I can promise you, the CCP, it's their least favorite news. If you want the CCP's least favorite newspaper to come into your mailbox, go to iReadEpoch.com. And for $1, your first month's subscription is only $1. That is iReadEpoch.com. The code is Jason Jones there. And we need monthly donors. We are in a campaign to cover all of our operating costs through monthly donors. And the best way to do that, which allows us to greatly grow our work, is for you to support our work directly. Go to thegreatcampaign.org, click on the donate button. First of all, look at everything we do. Look at it. Read what we write. Look at what we do. You can see it all there. And if you don't say, I've never seen anything like this in my life. If you don't say, I have never seen an organization do work like this in my life, then don't donate to us. If you're like, if you say I've never seen it, donate. If you're like, I see a lot of groups do stuff like this, then go donate to them, because you're not seeing other groups do what we do. We stand with the most vulnerable people in the world when no one is looking, when the cameras are gone, when people say, are you sure you should be doing that right now? I don't know if now's the time. Yeah, that's the time. When the cameras show up, when the foundations show up, when the governments show up, we leave, right? Palm Sunday, I'm not there on Palm Sunday. I don't like crowds. I'll be there at the cross, and that's what we do at the Vulnerable People Project, thegreatcampaign.org. Become a monthly donor. I have to shave. I'm about to have lunch with the former president of Mongolia, and we're going to talk to him about the CCP's crimes against Mongolia, the CCP's crimes against the Uyghur, and the CCP's crimes against Taiwan, their savaging of Hong Kong, and we're going to advocate for the Catholics and the bishops and to get them free. And we're going to find out about what Brie said, this great new bishop in Mongolia. We'll find out about that. All right. Until next time, Jason Jones Show.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.